Those Space People, a podcast series of casual cosmic conversations with people working on exciting space projects. Welcome to Thermal Lens, a special series focusing on thermal remote sensing, created by me, your host, Rachana Mamidi, Agnieszka Sojinska, and Jennifer Susan Adams. Agnieszka is currently a research associate at the University of Leicester in the UK and has been working in the area of thermal remote sensing since 2017. Jennifer is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Zurich in Switzerland and is currently focusing on measuring land surface temperature over forests. Agnieszka and Jennifer are also chairpersons of the Thermal Remote Sensing Special Interest Group of EIRCSEL, the European Association of Remote Sensing Laboratories. This group aims to bring together all the relevant stakeholders and provides a communication platform in the form of workshops, special sessions, seminars, and more. In today's episode, Jennifer and I are excited to chat with Mary Langsdale, an environmental scientist at King's College London. With a background in mathematics and a PhD in remote sensing, Mary is recently back from a multinational ESA and NASA co-funded campaign that aimed to quantify the effect of directionality on LST, land surface temperature data, using airborne and ground measurements. Tune in for some fascinating revelations from this campaign and an in-depth conversation on the various challenges surrounding LST data. Wrapping up, Mary weighs in on the critical skills and mindset needed to excel in the field of remote sensing. Welcome to the podcast, Mary.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Mary, you ran a joint ESA-NASA campaign this year to understand the challenges when working with land surface temperature data and trying to correct for these challenges during using a bunch of different techniques. So can you take us through what kind of challenges these are and also a little bit about this campaign? And for those listening, if you want to know more about land surface temperature, or you find that term quite new, feel free to check out the 32nd episode of Those Space People, where Mike Perry from the University of Leicester talks all about land surface temperature. So, yeah, Mary, over to you.
Yeah, land surface temperature, as Mike will have talked about, is a very complex issue. But one of the areas that's quite often overlooked is the fact that land surface temperature is actually a directional measurement. It corresponds to something, the kind of signal that's seen within the sensor field of view. And this sensor field of view will have a particular direction to it. And the thing that's annoying is that land surface temperature has a very strong directional component. So the direction you're looking at, whether that's the compass direction, so like north, south, east or west, or whether it's the view zenith angle, so that would be where we go from zero, where you're looking straight down to the edge of the swath, which can, for some satellites, can be up to like 60 degrees. Those two aspects, they strongly control the land surface temperature that you actually measure.
Okay, you mentioned directionality. So can you talk a little bit about directionality and why or how does it matter from space? And is it different when you're measuring from an airborne sensor or from ground? And, you know, a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. Directionality is, if you work with optical data and optical sensors, you might be more quite familiar with BRDF. And directionality in the thermal is something which is quite similar to that. It's not equivalent, but it is very similar. When we're looking at the thermal, we've got three things that tend to drive directionality. The first, which is probably the easiest to account for, is the atmosphere itself. So that would be the fact that if you're looking straight down at a surface compared to if you're looking at an angle, due to trigonometry, your angular measurement is going to be having a longer path to travel through. And that longer path length means you've got more atmosphere to travel through and you get more atmospheric attenuation. So you have to account for those when you're doing your actual measurements. The second thing that drives directionality is the sun itself. So you might be quite familiar with this. If, say, you get in a plane, you're flying somewhere and maybe the sun is setting, and when it's quite low in the sky, it can be reflected off water or something else, which is specular, that you see this sun glint. And what we see is quite similar in the thermal, where that will be like a hot spot at the direct point where the sun is being reflected. But because this means that the sun has a kind of component to play in directionality. That's going to change during the day. You're going to get some times when the sun's driving, causing shadows on the ground and things like this. You've got different sorts of reflection depending on when the sun is. So that means you've got a diurnal pattern to directionality as well. And the final thing that drives directionality in thermal is something, it's just the surface itself. And that can be particularly difficult to account for, because even if you've got a surface where it's completely made of one material, it's going to reflect differently depending on the direction at which you view it at. And that's because emissivity itself has a directional component. But the second thing is, if you've got a surface which has got very mixed components, so say you've got like a field where you've got some crops, you've got some soil, they've got very different temperatures. And if you're looking straight down at that field, you might see a mixture of the crops and soil. So you're going to get, your signal will be composed of the two of those. But if you're looking at the field from an angle, you might be seeing mostly the sides of the vegetation. So your signal's mostly going to be from that vegetation. And that's the temperature that you'll be looking at, which means that you get typically a cooler temperature when you look at it from an angle. So all of those three things, you've got the atmosphere, you've got the sun itself, and then you've got the surface itself. Those are what drive directionality. Yeah, and it's definitely very different depending on the different scales. So what we've seen in our studies, for example, is at a very local scale, at a very small scale when you're looking at the ground, things like row orientation seem to be really big drivers and directionality. But when you're looking from a satellite scale, it's much harder to understand whether that's the case, because your pixel there is typically maybe 1 kilometer for thermal data. So that might be the entire field. And it's harder to see whether that's going to be such a driver just because we don't have as much data, which lets us know about that.
Yeah, related to everything that you just said about scales. So obviously, when we look at things very close, so let's say we go to an urban environment which has lots of shadowing and lots of sunlit areas, so we would expect to see quite a big directionality component there. And it's the same with vineyards or these kind of agricultural fields that have the row structure crops, as you mentioned. So how can we actually measure directionality at different scales? What kind of techniques do we have to do this from the very local scale up to the satellite scale? And do we have data that can actually let us look at this? Because I guess what we actually need is multi-angular data, right? So we need data that's at exactly the same point when the sun is shining in a specific angle and the view is the same, that we need to actually have different viewing angles. So yeah, how can we... It's a difficult concept to do at different scales, right? And to measure this.
Yeah, definitely. The simplest way to actually do it is just, in theory, if you were able to do this, you'd be able to make measurements of directionality. If you were able to have observations of the same surface at exactly the same time at two different angles. On the ground, for like ground scale experiments, this is a little bit of a faff to do, but you can do it. You just have to set up a number of different instruments. That might be radiometers, thermal cameras, things like this. You would have to set them up and have them so they're either recording at exactly the same time, or if that's not possible, in very close succession, because LST can change very quickly over short time scales, annoyingly. But so ground scale wise, it's quite easy to do that. But if you're going further abroad, like up to airborne scale or satellite scale, that's a lot harder. It's very rare to get satellite measurements which are taken at the same time of the same surface using two different angles. There was one satellite which did it in the past, but that's no longer something which is available to us.
Sorry, you said that. Why do you say that it's not available to us? Because most of the data is archived, right? All remote sensing data is in archives and can be extracted?
Yeah, so it is, but I was only going to be in a couple of bands. So the observatory is no longer collecting data. We have that archival data, definitely, but the sensor itself is no longer operational. And because it's of a particular, got those particular spectral features and particular spectral bands, you're only going to observe in those. So you sometimes can't understand what that would mean for other satellites and other sensors. And you might have locations only over certain points or areas. You might not have observations over, for example, certain parts of the globe. So you might have not have observations over glaciers from this or things like this.
Is it possible to correct for directionality after the measurements have been made and the sensor, like you said, is no longer available?
Yeah, there are a couple of ways you could do this. The main one seems to be using models. themselves. Because directionality is very complex, because it's got those kind of drivers, which is related to the surface, the sun, the atmosphere. In terms of atmosphere, that's quite easy to correct for, because you can use like a radiative transfer model with an atmospheric profile or some reanalysis data. So that's quite easy to account for. But the surface stuff is really quite complex, because it depends on a lot of parameters. Models have been developed which can correct for this. So you've got either ones which are about like geometric models, where they have a lot of information about the surface structure, or you've got something called parametric models, which are models that basically use observations in order to feed into this. And they're a bit simpler. But annoyingly, both models are still quite complex. And because of this, most operational algorithms don't actually have a directional correction approach, really. But this is changing. Directionality, because it has quite a strong impact, and it's becoming increasingly recognized to have a strong impact in LST retrieval and the accuracy of the LST retrieval. There's a huge focus on this at the moment. And anyone who went to the ESA workshop on thermal remote sensing last year would have seen loads of research coming out about directionality and the impact that it has on future satellite missions and existing products and things like this. So there's a big push, and the campaign that I was part of, this push to really understand driver's directionality in advance of these future thermal missions that will be launched in the upcoming years. There's actually also, sorry to interrupt, there's an additional, some really cool work happening on not just correcting for the products themselves, correcting in kind of post-production, but also looking into modifying the algorithms themselves to account for directionality. So for example, in previous podcasts, I know you've talked about the TESS algorithm, the temperature and emissivity separation algorithm, which is one which is used most, is one of the kind of strongest ones we have operationally for multispectral imagery, because it's able to retrieve LST and emissivity directly. So you don't have to make any assumptions about the emissivity or the surface. But because it uses emissivity, the way it retrieves emissivity and LST simultaneously is it uses some predetermined calibration curves which link emissivity to the spectral contrast. So this has input of particular variables and the emissivity particular inputs as information that it's using. But emissivity has a directional component. So what we're seeing now is that some of the scientists who work on these algorithms, they're actually incorporating a directional component into that calibration curve so that they can try and include directionality in all of this assessment. So that's really interesting work that's happening as well.
I want to touch a little bit on the emissivity. So I was wondering, Mary, if you could first explain what emissivity is, and then also why different surfaces might have different directional components related to their surface.
Yeah, so emissivity is basically the ratio of the radiation that's emitted by an object compared to the radiation that would be emitted by a black body, which is a kind of theoretically perfect emitter, which emits according to Planck's law. So emissivity is also being considered to be a kind of a spectral fingerprint. I think that's one way of describing it, because it's unique to each material. So you'll see, for example, water has a very different emissivity to rocks. But then even within the category of rocks, you've got emissivity of one particular type of rock will be very different to another type. So you can use it to identify particular materials. But what this means also is that this is why different materials will have different directionality things. Yeah, so emissivity, each material has a different emissivity, and then that emissivity itself has a different directionality, if that makes sense. Because basically stuff that absorbs at different wavelengths will reflect differently and will have different reflectance properties, and that controls the directionality as well.
Yeah, so I guess when we're talking about soil roughness could be a really great example of that, or the amount of moisture that's in soil. I guess if it's super rough compared to super homogeneous, then this would change the directionality of the emissivity, right? But maybe it's also due to the actual properties of the rocks themselves and the chemical and biophysical parameters.
Yeah, it's related to so much around the kind of structure, exactly as you said, real directionality stuff with ploughed fields compared to much more kind of smoother fields. And this is, it's like when you think about, for example, polished marble compared to just sawn marble. There's just sawn one that is much more like a Lambertian, what we call a Lambertian reflector, because it will reflect in each of the different directions. Whereas a very smooth and very polished marble is a bit more like a mirror. So it's what we call a specular reflector, and it has a bit more of those properties. So those will be controlling how the patterns of reflectance from that particular surface are.
Are these features used in some way to quantify or measure directionality?
Unfortunately, at the moment, it's not something which is used, and partly it's just because it's not really understood. And there have been lots of studies into this, but it's not really understood how we would actually take account of this and incorporate that into our models. One of the big things that we're seeing is a difference between the ability for us to model very local scenes compared to how we might do this on a larger scale. For example, if I had a really local study, which is a small scale study, then I might be able to use something called DART, which was a radiative transfer model, which is developed by the team at CESBIO. And it's a fantastic model, really good for modeling directionality, but you need a lot of input. So you need to have, for example, if I was looking to model a crop field, I'd need to know the spacing between the rows. I'd need to know the height of each of the individual crop plants, the standard deviation across the field of the different heights, the emissivity of the soil, the component temperatures, all of these things. The list really does go on. When you've got a small scale study, you can account for all of this. And that is where we might see things like the different reflectance properties of the different materials coming into play. But when you have a much larger scale and you're looking to, for example, correct a satellite product over a long time series, it's a lot harder. You're not able to model each individual image. And that's where we use instead stuff like parametric models.
Are there any particular applications where this matters more, where the thermal directionality or the lack of the inability to quantify this matters in any particular applications more than other applications?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the first thing to say here is directionality only really starts to come into play above about 20 degrees view zenith angles and the thermal. That's much higher than we're seeing in the optical. So anyone who's worked just with optical data will think that you've got much more data you can use. The directionality itself is only really going to come into play above 20 to 30 degrees, depending on the surface. So if you're looking at very small angles, you're not really going to have to deal with this. But as you go beyond that, you do need to account for it, definitely. And this is where your surface itself will have an impact. So as we've talked about, something like an urban environment or vineyards, as Jennifer said, those which have lots of different, more heterogeneous environments, those will have much stronger directionality, because the different component temperatures mean that the area which you're looking at will change, the temperature which you're looking at will change depending on the area that you're looking at. And that's where directionality really comes into play. The other aspects of directionality, so to do with the emissivity, those are a bit easier to correct for. So when you've got a much more homogeneous environment, you can use pre-established models or relationships between emissivity and angle, which are easier to account for than heterogeneous environments where you really have to rely on using models.
Coming back to what you mentioned about the field of view being, if it's more than 20 degrees, then it's something that we have to consider. So obviously, we know building up a long time series of land surface temperature data is really critical for many different types of applications related to climate, but also related to the surface properties. And I guess to do this, we need maybe different sensors. And probably all of these different sensors have different field of views and different kind of, the amount of directionality that they have changes depending on the sensor and on the satellite. So is this something that has been considered before when we're trying to build up these long data series of land surface temperature? Or is it something that maybe hasn't been looked at properly, and it's something that we really need to focus our efforts on?
It's a really good question. And consistency experiments and studies have been done looking at how different satellite products will relate to each other. This is not something that I've directly been involved in, but if you look at the ESA GlobTemp project or the Land Surface CCI work, they've done loads of work comparing, for example, MODIS data records against Landsat data records, and a lot of the studies there are really in depth and really good on that. What I do notice from this, however, is that often they mask out the edges of the swath, because those are where we're going to see the most directional effects. And in products, because we don't have a lot of operationally, you don't have a lot of correction for directionality, they might have a quality flag, which indicates that these observations are slightly less accurate, or at least the uncertainties on these observations is greater. But I don't know how much people are taking that into account when they're using the observations, of course. So it really is something which we do need to consider, because if we don't, then you might say, for example, you were using an image, go back to that crop field that I've talked about. Say I was using a data series record, which had observations looking down a nadir of this crop field. And then I decided to have extra data coming from a different satellite, which only had observations at an angle. Those observations would be cooler, typically, than the nadir observations I'm looking at. So if I didn't account for directionality, then what would be happening is I would think, oh, temperatures are actually getting cooler in these particular times. So actually that means that climate change isn't happening, you might say, or global warming's not happening in this particular crop field. And that could lead you to have incorrect assumptions around your interpretations or anything like this. So it is really important that we take it into account.
I guess that becomes even more important because in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have a lot more thermal missions that are being launched, either from ESA side, so the LSTM mission, from NASA side, so this would be the SPG mission, but we also have like national agencies like the Trishna mission from CNES and ESRO, and all of these missions actually have unprecedented high spatial resolution, so I guess they're going to be affected even more by directionality. However, it's such a unique kind of data set that we might be able to get out of such data. So I guess trying to understand and correct for directionality is going to be really critical in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, definitely. But that's why we're seeing so much effort from each of those different partners, the organizations who are putting those missions about. They're really looking into directionality at the moment. So hopefully we're going to get some really good understanding and develop this operationally.
Now that both of you mentioned these large missions and the large agencies behind them, how exactly does one go about organizing or running these huge campaigns in the remote sensing field, Mary? But how exactly do you go about, first of all, identifying what issues to talk about and how do you approach these organizations? How do you go about the whole thing?
We actually didn't approach the organization, in this case, the European Space Agency, who, in part of their LSTM design studies, they recognized that they needed to have real data which could be used to understand directionality. Because models are fantastic, models have such a great part to play, but you can't get real world observations. There is a gap there between what the models are telling you is happening and actually what you're seeing in real life. In some cases, you've got fantastic match up between models and observations. But for example, we did a ground-based study on directionality a couple of years ago, where we had observations using this setup we'd created so that we could make multiple measurements of the surface at the similar time. And we compared the results to what we're seeing with a model. The model suggests we get one thing, but the observations themselves, actually you've got much more precipitation, for example, or you've got, not precipitation, you've got irrigation within the field that might cause particular areas to get wet at certain times because you might have a bit of a leaky pipe, whereas the model doesn't account for anything like that. But that means in terms of the temperature itself, your data there means you've got a bit of a cooler area because your soil's wet, and that will influence the results. So it's really important that you have campaigns like this within the scale of these larger satellite missions in order to actually understand what you're seeing And in particular as well for satellite studies, because directionality has such a scaling issue, it's very useful for us to have airborne measurements, because airborne measurements allow us to simulate what a satellite's seeing much more than we get from our ground measurements, which are like point-based little samples. And whereas an airborne measurement, particularly an airborne measurement with hyperspectral sensors such as this one, from this you can directly actually simulate a satellite observation and a few pixels at least.
So speaking of directionality, is there complete consensus on different aspects related to it in the scientific community, or are there any conflicting viewpoints, or how is it inside?
Yeah, I think it's completely recognized, at least amongst the communities I've been speaking to, that in LST we need to account for directionality. There's probably some different approaches around how to do this. And I come from quite a field-based background. I look at a lot of data. I look at a lot of airborne data. I look at satellite data. I look at ground data. So for me, looking at data feels really key to this. But I know there are other people who say the models can do a lot of this work, and we don't need the data to complement that because that work has been already done. So maybe that's one area where you've got conflict. But for me, I would say always data is key.
I would like to talk a bit more in depth about what you mentioned about the airborne hyperspectral sensor that you used during the campaign. So I was wondering what kind of data you collected, what kind of measurements you conducted, what kind of experiments you did. As far as I remember, it was a pretty long campaign where you were based down in Italy for a couple of months or something when it was flooding and raining and then really hot. It would be great to hear a bit more about what kind of data you collected.
Yeah, of course. So it was a fantastic campaign and one which we put a lot of work into, and as did all of our project partners. So it was an ESA and NASA funded campaign that happened between May and July last year, so 2023. And we had a huge number of collaborators on this project. And this is part because it was a project which didn't just have one objective. So directionality was a big part of it. But then we also had a lot of other objectives within the wider campaign. So for example, you had industrial objectives, you had glacier monitoring, so cryospheric objectives, you've got, what else, urban objectives, you're looking at geothermal areas, loads of different components to this. And as part of that, we saw flights happen in Italy, which is where I was mostly based. But then also the aircraft went over to France and to Switzerland. So really exciting one that happened. Yeah. In terms of the sensors themselves, for most of the flights, there was just one aircraft, which was a NASA JPL's hyperspectral sensor called HITES, the hyperspectral thermal emission spectrometer. And HITES has got 256 bands across the long wave infrared, so you can get loads of good information from there, especially for simulating satellites such as LSTM, SPG, and Trishner. So it's loads of great data is coming from this, and we're seeing that happening now. But in terms of the directionality flights, which is what I was directly involved in, that's what I was leading on, we also had an additional aircraft, which was supplied by the British Antarctic Survey, on which we mounted a lot of sensors, which we have here at King's College London as part of the National Centre for Earth Observation in the UK. One of them was something called the OWL, which is a commercial hyperspectral sensor, which has got 102 bands across the long wave infrared. So not as many as HITES, but still a lot and very useful for simulating satellite products. And this owl we mounted in a special device so that we could tilt it between flight lines. So you could do one flight line and then you could have it looking straight down, and then you could fly a second line. And in between, in the time it's taken to move and orient yourself and line up for that next line, and we've pressed a button and we've changed the angle so that the owl is looking at an angle. The whole sensor was shifted effectively. And this meant that we could collect data at lots of different observations. We could actually collect data using the owl from 0 up to 48 degrees off nadir. Within that, we're covering the entire range of angles that would be seen by LSTM, and which means we can really simulate that. And the reason you might be thinking, oh, okay, you've got two aircraft, why do you need two aircraft? And this really comes back to this fact that LST can change really quickly with time. The temperature itself can really change with time. So if you're doing an airborne campaign, because it's really quite complex to get any airborne sensors going, you might only have one aircraft, and which, if you wanted to look at directionality, you would fly one flight line and then you would loop around and fly your second flight line so that your sensor can look at the same surface, but at a different angle. But that might take 5 minutes between flight lines. And in that time, we learned in previous campaigns that the surface can change quite quickly. And it's really hard to understand whether your observations, the differences you're seeing between that first flight line and the second flight line are due to the changes in time, so the surface heating or cooling, or whether it's due to directionality. So by having two aircraft, we were able to reduce that uncertainty and reduce that temporal component so that we could fly the two aircraft pretty much side by side to get observations of the same surface at the same time or very near the same time. So that's why that was the whole purpose of the campaign, really, was to try and really get this wealth of data set so that we could understand that.
It sounds like a huge effort and a massive campaign. Yeah. And did you, I guess the whole key to this, it's also the accuracy of the airborne data that you acquire, right? And you mentioned this about timing, but did you also acquire some ground validation measurements to make sure that what you're getting from the aircraft is, not to say a true land surface temperature, but an accurate one, or you at least have a way to quantify the uncertainty?
Yeah, you've really hit the nail on the point there. It was so important for us to understand not just the absolute performance of each of the sensors, but also how they performed compared to each other, because you've got two very different sensors. They operate, they're quite similar, but they operate in different ways. The algorithms that we apply to them are different. All of this information means that the products you're getting might be different, even if you were looking at the same surface at exactly the same time. So we had loads of ground-based measurements, which were collecting LST, emissivity, and lots of other things, so that we could understand how those two sensors performed. And we also did black body comparisons using the same black body, where we've got both sensors on the ground, so that we get an idea of the relative performance there. And then finally, we did flights where we would fly at the same altitude within a couple of minutes, because obviously you can't have the two aircraft operating at the same altitude in airspace. Otherwise, the military zone where we were flying in meant we wouldn't be able to fly anymore. But we would have them separated by time, but fly over the same targets so that we could actually see how they measured on a target, which was very stable over time.
Wow. Sounds like a very fun campaign. I wish I could take part in something like this in the future.
Yeah, it was fun. Fun's one word. In hindsight, it was very fun. And at the time, it was very busy. But we've got an amazing data set.
For a non-expert user, is there something like a checklist that they need to run their LST products through to check for directionality or any particular things they need to be careful about?
I would say look in the algorithm documents, so the ATBDs, to see if they make any corrections or account for directionality at the moment. Generally, you probably won't find that they do. So that will give you a bit of information about whether you can use observations towards the edge of the swath, so observations with higher angles, or whether not. Or whether you can always still use them, but you just want to, when you're considering your interpretations, have thought about directionality there.
And related to maybe some of the users that don't know much about directionality or the impact that it might have on LST and downstream products, what kind of inaccuracies does that place on the data? So are we seeing something like 0.01 degrees and then we're just being picky scientists, or are we actually seeing uncertainties that are a lot higher than this? And it's something that even people that don't often work with LST data still need to keep in mind if they want to work with accurate products.
Yeah, it's unfortunately not 0.01. What we are seeing does vary depending on the different surface, as I've said. But generally, studies will report that as we go towards the higher view angles that are observed by satellites, we get up to between 5 and 9 Kelvin difference between nadir and non-nadir observations. Now, that's at the kind of towards the very edge. What we tend to see it more with a lot of the satellites that we might use from polar orbiting satellites, for example, have the LST products there. The impacts, as I've said, really do start to play around 30 degrees. And there we might see maybe 2 to 3 Kelvin. So it's not as much, but it's still definitely important to consider. There's some studies that have been done over urban environments where you've got 16 degrees Kelvin difference. So it's huge. amounts there. And in heterogeneous environments, we're really seeing that impact, particularly over urban, where you've got such strong, so many different temperatures, where you've got some shadows, which really start to play. You've got green spaces, you've got really hot tarmac, which will heat up massively. Those are where we see the worst effects.
And I guess related to the, so generally speaking for satellite missions, depending on the product, we also have some accuracy requirements, right? They're often set out by bodies such as the GCOS or the World Meteorological Organization. And is there an accuracy requirement for land surface temperature? And what is that? And how much is directionality contributing towards this?
Yeah, there is. The GCOS, I think the user requirements from GCOS are 1 to 2 Kelvin accuracy for LST. And so directionality alone is probably, if you're looking at the high angle observations, you're going to be way exceeding that. And that doesn't even take into account emissivity, the atmosphere, which are both huge drivers of uncertainty and huge sources of uncertainty in LST.
Well, so it's a massive contribution.
Yeah. Obviously, nadir observations, not so much. So I don't want to paint a kind of doom and gloom only, but it's definitely something we need to account for.
So we've been talking so far about mostly about directionality being one of the biggest challenges of LST data and data products. Are there any other key challenges of generating while generating this data or while working with LST data?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are two main challenges in my mind. One, which is emissivity. It's more and more studies are coming out recently, which indicate that emissivity is not as well understood as we would want it to be for LST. And it's very difficult to retrieve emissivity because the retrieval itself is something which we call an undetermined problem, where you have N plus one unknowns because you've got emissivity in each band for a satellite. And then you also have LST. But when you have an observation, you're only going to have N observations because you're going to have an observation for each satellite band, which means that you are, it's something called an undetermined problem, basically. You need to make assumptions in order to get what you want to get, which is your LST and your emissivity from the number of observations you have. So emissivity, I think, is one of the biggest one issues that we have, partly because also you've got lots of studies, as I said, coming out which show, for example, that the top of a leaf have a different emissivity to the bottom of the leaf. How do we account for that when we're matching up our lab measurements, which are using maybe like the individual leaf measurements? How do we account for that when we're looking at a satellite observation of a forest even? Where are our measurements coming from? Do we use the top of the leaf? Do we use the bottom of the leaf? It's such a small thing, but how do we scale up from our lab measurements of emissivity into our satellite observations, particularly if we're having to make assumptions around emissivity that because of this undetermined nature of the problem? I would say also to add to that, the emissivity itself is obviously a problem. But what I also think is a huge challenge in LST is matching up between LST observations on the ground and satellite observations. So accounting for the fact that LST is not just very spatially heterogeneous and variable, but also that LST changes so quickly over time. So your satellite observation is like a snapshot in time, and you have to really understand how you're going to match that up to your surface observation, which will be influenced by a lot of things. You've got surface turbulence, which means you've got a lot of changes happening on very rapid timescale. Yeah, it's really a challenging one for people who work in the kind of validation area when we're trying to understand how our LST products are actually performing.
I guess as the spatial resolution of thermal imagery improves with time, this problem that you just mentioned of measuring the top of the leaf and the bottom of the leaf, these kind of problems are only going to be more evident because for now, probably in satellite imagery, everything is getting averaged out across large areas because the spatial resolution is quite large, is quite small.
Yeah, these problems will become much more pertinent, definitely. But I think also, on a hopeful note, we actually might be able to understand them much better because the satellite observations will be multispectral. We'll be able to use something like the TESS algorithm to retrieve LST and emissivity simultaneously, so we don't have to make assumptions. And we can actually use that to understand drivers at these large scales in a way that's been previously not possible. It is both going to be a source of particular focus, but I think also one where we'll be able to make some real progress with these high resolution images.
Coming back to this changing landscape of how thermal remote sensing is going to look with all of these new missions. And we've mentioned a lot directionality and emissivity. And I was wondering, as you've already mentioned, validation, do we need to change our current validation strategies for these upcoming LST missions to account for this high spatial scales that we're going to look at? So I guess with directionality, we know that we might have to change this, but with emissivity, is this something that we have to consider? Do we need to consider like new measurement techniques, new instruments, new different types of sensors or different algorithms or ways of looking at things from the ground?
So I think actually it gives us an opportunity to really improve our validation techniques. So at the moment, a lot of validation work is limited to very homogeneous areas. So you've got deserts, lakes, oceans, if you're looking at sea surface temperature, but we tend to stay away from more variable areas in terms of the land cover, because it's a lot harder to get measurements on the surface which are representative of what the satellite would see, which is a much larger kind of pixel integration of each of the different land cover types and their signals. As we move towards smaller scale and higher resolutions, that is going to mean that we can actually consider a lot more regions than we've previously been able to consider in terms of validation. And I would really hope to see with that we get the advance of a lot of new validation stations, which are more representative of the huge diversity on Earth that we have in terms of land cover types.
Mary, I wanted to ask you, you have a background in mathematics and of course a PhD in remote sensing and amongst other degrees. So for someone to pursue a career in remote sensing, or let's say thermal remote sensing, what kind of skills or what kind of degrees are needed?
Ooh, yeah, I'm from a maths background, and people in my team, we've got a lot of physicists, we've got a lot of geographers, and we've got a chemist even. Anyone who's got who is interested in science, I think, will be able to get into remote sensing. I really think there's so many different applications in remote sensing that even if you wanted to stay away from like focusing just on the technical data or doing just retrievals, you're able to use the data itself to focus on something which you're interested in. And that moving away from science, platforms like Google Earth Engine mean that now, as long as you're able to work a bit with code, which I think lots of people are able to teach themselves and embrace, then you can actually use the data without necessarily even needing to do the processing steps. Instead, for example, we're seeing, because of that, lots of applications which go into the economy or looking at humanitarian research, things scoped like this. There's even space archaeology that's emerging. So you've got a whole variety of applications. And I think for that reason, we shouldn't really limit anyone going into remote sensing. But in terms of technical skills, my day probably consists of being very stubborn about problem solving, wanting to focus on that. So if you like problem solving, you'll be good at that. Doing coding, that again is mostly just being stubborn, I think, and being persistent when you think that you come across a kind of barrier there. So if you have the ability to really want to look at kind of problem solving and technical coding and things like this, I think you'll have a very good ability to have a career in this.
Now that you mentioned a lot of coding, you also previously mentioned a lot of open questions, a lot of open problems for which we are yet to find solutions, be it in terms of modeling or trying to quantify something. Do you think, I'm sure people are using a lot of AI and machine learning algorithms for this. So do you see AI solving a lot of these problems, or do you think it's too complex?
I think AI's got a really strong contribution to remote sensing. In particular, you've got machine learning, which means that we're able now to process data on a scale which we've never been able to really work with before. And then you've got some things emerging from there as well of using remote sensing data as the input to particular algorithms, which means that, and from this, people aren't discovering things that they would never have seen patterns in before. So that's a huge, AI is going to really have a massive contribution to this field. But don't think AI can do it alone, if that makes sense. I think it's very much someone guiding and supporting through. And in case of supervised learning techniques, you're going to be putting in that data, you're looking at what you want to get the output, you're directing these algorithms to which particular data sets you want to look at. There's still a huge human component. So I wouldn't at this stage say that we should run away from AI and remote sensing. And I think we should really embrace it, but work with it.
Yeah, of course, it's only a tool and very likely it's going to remain a tool. It's going to need human intelligence after all.
Yeah, yeah. Some of my colleagues who are very into sci-fi probably would disagree with me there, but I definitely think there's some amazing studies to do with machine learning and remote sensing at the moment. And I really encourage anyone who's going into remote sensing to look into that because it just allows us to process more data than we've ever been able to do previously. And it's so good to see.
Yeah, that's been a very enlightening episode for me. I've learned so much today just from this 1 hour because I don't come from a remote sensing background. Like the rest of our audience, I'm a very curious onlooker when it comes to remote sensing. So it's been very informative, very educational for me. Thank you so much for your time, Mary. It's been super fun.
Oh, no, thank you. It's been really nice talking about it. It's nice reflecting on the campaign as well, when so much work went into it, not just from our team, but from all the different organizations to make it happen, because things like the airborne campaigns are so difficult. They're logistically very challenging. You've got to do all these permissions, all of these things. And we're starting to get data coming back from the campaign now. And it's really nice to see all of that effort that's come about. So thank you for letting me talk about it today.
Are there any publicly available resources or links that we can access to know more about the campaign and the results?
There definitely are some blog posts out there. I know that at King's we've done a couple of them. NCO, the National Centre of Earth Observation, did some summaries, and I'll be sure to send you the links afterwards. There's a couple, if you're going to EGU, for example, I'll be presenting on the campaign itself and showing some preliminary research in one of the sessions there. And then some of my colleagues are presenting at various conferences later in the year as well. So you might see and hear about us on the conference network circuit.
Great. So I'm going to add these links anyways in the description of the podcast for those listening.
And there's also, if anyone does want to learn more about directionality, there's an incredible review paper from 2019, which I will send to you as well.
I just wanted to say thank you so much to Mary for, letting us know a bit more about this topic, because as we've heard, it's such an important thing that we have to account for, but not everyone knows what it is, how to look for it, how to account for it. And I think it's really nice to let expert and non-expert users of LST know about it and, know how to start thinking about it.
Oh, thank you. It's been really interesting.